Genesis chapter 20, if you would, please. We've gone through a portion of Scripture like this before. It's back in Genesis chapter 12. So if as we read through this story, it sounds like we've already been there. We have, but not in this particular passage. I didn't forget in my sermon preaching schedule, and just found it easier this week to preach the same message twice. Well, this is actually another rendition. Second verse, same as the first, if you will. Genesis chapter 20, let's go ahead and read this passage. Genesis 20, beginning in verse 1. From Hebron, where Abram had been, Abraham journeyed toward the territory of the Negev, that's south, and lived between Kadesh and Shur. And he sojourned in Gerar, and Abraham said of Sarah his wife, "She is my sister." And Abimelech, king of Gerar, sent and took Sarah. But God came to Abimelech in a dream by night and said to him, "Behold, you are a dead man because of the woman whom you've taken, for she is a man's wife." Now Abimelech had not approached her. So he said, "Lord, will you kill an innocent people? Did he not himself say to me that she is my sister? And she herself said, 'He is my brother.' In the integrity of my heart and the innocence of my hands I have done this." Then God said to him in the dream, "Yes, I know that you have done this in the integrity of your heart, and it was I who kept you from sinning against me. Therefore, I did not let you touch her. Now then, return the man's wife, for he is a prophet, so that he will pray for you and you shall live. But if you do not return her, know that you shall surely die, you and all who are yours." So Abimelech rose early in the morning and called all his servants and told them all these things. And the men were very much afraid. Then Abimelech called Abraham and said to him, "What have you done to us? How have I sinned against you, that you have brought on me and my kingdom a great sin? You have done to me things that ought not to be done." And Abimelech said to Abraham, "What did you see that you did this thing?" Abraham said, "I did it because I thought, 'There is no fear of God at all in this place, and they will kill me because of my wife. Besides, she is indeed my sister, the daughter of my father, though not the daughter of my mother, and she became my wife. And when God caused me to wander from my father's house, I said to her, 'This is the kindness that you must do to me. At every place to which we come, say of me, "He is my brother."'" Then Abimelech took sheep and oxen and male servants and female servants and gave them to Abraham and returned Sarah his wife to him. And Abimelech said, "Behold, my land is before you. Dwell where it pleases you." And to Sarah he said, "Behold, I have given your brother 1,000 pieces of silver. It is a sign of your innocence in the eyes of all who are with you, and before everyone you are vindicated." Then Abraham prayed to God, and God healed Abimelech, and also healed his wife and female slaves, so that they bore children. For the Lord had closed all the wombs of the house of Abimelech because of Sarah, Abraham's wife. I heard a story recently of a teacher who came to his wit's end as he was teaching high school students. It was one of those classes where the choice seats were the back row seats, and you got there early to get in the back. The more unfortunate ones found themselves in the front row, and as the teacher was pouring himself into this subject, he soon discovered, again, that they could have cared less about this subject or any other subject. They weren't in the mood to learn. They weren't in the mind frame to learn. And about the middle of the lesson, he'd had it, and he grabbed a piece of chalk and whipped around and turned to the blackboard and wrote across the blackboard, "Apathy." A-P-A-T-H-Y, and he puts a big exclamation point at the end and breaks the chalk in the middle of the process and turns around and walks out of the room. And there's a couple guys sitting in the front row, and the one guy is looking at it and leans over, A-P-A-T-H-Y. He turns to his friend and he says, "What's a pathy?" And the other guy doesn't even look. He says, "Who cares?" If you didn't quite get that, apathy means to not care, okay? So, he got the answer right, but he was demonstrating what it means to be apathetic. A.W. Tozer, writing back in the 60s, wrote this. One of the big milk companies back at this time makes capital of the fact that their cows are all satisfied with their lot. Their clever ads have made the term contented cows familiar to anyone. You remember who the contented cows are? What company was that? Carnation. See, that just tells how old. I had no idea what this was talking about even. But what is virtue in a cow may be vice in a man. Contentment with earthly goods is the mark of a saint. Contentment with our spiritual state is a mark of inward blindness. One of the greatest foes of the Christian religion is complacency. Complacency. Orthodox Christianity has fallen to its present lowest state from lack of a spiritual desire. Among the many who profess the Christian faith, scarcely one in a thousand reveals any passionate thirst for God. Why? Because we're just too content. We're too content with where we are spiritually. I think we need to ask why the apathy, why the complacency, why the indifference? Perhaps it's because we've become accustomed to grace. Isn't that a little bit, when we get used to something, we no longer count it as special, we just kind of take it for granted. It's no longer that big a deal anymore. And as we come to the text this morning, I think we'll find that when God's grace makes no difference in His people, then God's people become indifferent to God's grace. And that's what we'll find as we look at the life of Abraham. We're going to find, in fact, three characteristics or three marks of those who have become indifferent to the grace of God. God's grace is no longer amazing to us. And we all need to be careful because Abraham is called the father of the faith. And those who have faith at all must, to some degree, look like Father Abraham. But here's the thing. If Abraham, the father of the faith, was subject to apathy, was subject to indifference to grace, just maybe you and I might be susceptible to this same thing as well. So as we look into this text, we'll find three characteristics or three marks of a person who's become indifferent to God's grace. The first mark is that indifferent recipients of God's grace are heedless of their continued need of grace. Oftentimes when I receive something, I start to use it, I start to think that maybe it's me that is doing the thing rather than the gift that's been given or the grace that extended that gift for my use. Verses 1 through 7, we see that Abraham had grown in his knowledge of God and in his experience of grace. If we were to take some time and just review what's brought us to this point in the story, back in chapter 12, Abraham had demonstrated personal commitment as he exercised great sacrifice to leave the land of Ur of the Chaldees and make for the place that God said, I will show you. And God did. He brought him to the land of Canaan at great personal expense. He lost his father along the way. He had to say goodbye to all his father's household. He had to leave the place where he had grown up. We come to later in chapter 12, and we see that he went down to Egypt during a famine in the land. He did the same thing as he did here. He said, my wife is my sister. Pharaoh takes his wife. And in the end, God curses the Pharaoh, and Pharaoh gives back Abraham his wife and says, get out of my land. It was a very low point for Abraham, the man of faith, as he was subject to personal failure and public embarrassment. And so we see that he had to grow, and he did grow through that. Chapter 13, Lot and Abraham have too much stuff. And so Abraham comes to his younger kindred, and he says, you go ahead and choose which direction you want to go, and I'll go the other direction. And his young nephew says, I'll take the best land. You can have the scrubby stuff for yourself. And so again, at great personal loss, yet with great blessing, God comes to him and says, not only will I give you all of this, but I give you all of that as well. As far as your eye can see, I'll give you everything that you can see. And so God is continuing to grow him, to understand what it means to walk by faith, not by sight, to experience grace in his life. We come to chapter 14. Lot is captured along with other cities, Sodom and Gomorrah, and they're taken captive by the kings of Mesopotamia. And Abraham, with some 300 and a handful of men, goes and chases them down and gets public victory and brings them back. He slays the Mesopotamian kings. He comes back, and on the way back, he meets none other than Melchizedek, the priest king. And the king of Sodom says, you can have everything you want. You can have all of the booty, all of the goods that you've won by your sword. They belong to you. And Abraham says, no, I don't want you to enrich me. My blessings come from God. So at that moment, Abraham gains both a public victory and a private victory as he learns what it means to lean on God alone to take care of him through his life. Chapter 15. God comes to him, and Abraham's at a low moment in his life. He says, God, really? Is it just going to be a blessing? Am I going to leave everything to my servant? And God says, no, I will give you a son. I will give you a child from your own loins. Well, how will I know this, God? And God says, okay, I want you to cut in half these animals. And that night, God comes down with a smoking pot and a torch, and he alone walks between those cut apart animals, and God makes a covenant with Abraham. And we see that his private doubt is met with God's personal assurance in his life. And Abraham is growing as he understands God's grace a little bit more and a little bit more, chapter by chapter in his life, but he doesn't understand it very well when we come to chapter 16. He tries to manipulate things. Actually, Sarah has the idea and says, maybe you should just take my servant. Since I'm not having children, you can have a child by her. And so there's private manipulation, and then there's interpersonal tensions that come into the mix. And Abraham has to learn again that God hears. Ishmael, the God hears. We move on to chapter 17. There's more revelation. There's private submission as God gives him a sign of the covenant. Chapter 18, there's private fellowship as God comes and has a meal with Abraham in his tent. And then there's that intercession as Abraham prays for Sodom, prays for Gomorrah, prays for his nephew that God wouldn't extend judgment too harshly, but that God would extend mercy with judgment. Then as we just looked at in chapter 19, we see that as the story closes on the judgment of Sodom and Gomorrah, that there's Abraham in the distance watching as the smoke rises. He's just witnessed God's judgment on sin. And he's wondering, did Lot make it out in time? That's the context that we come to chapter 20. Abraham, the man of faith, has had lots of ups. He's had a few downs in the middle of this time. But through it all of the ups, all of the downs, he's learned to understand that he's walking by faith. He's learned to understand what it means to have God's grace operative in his life. And so you would think, with all that he's learned so far, there's no way he's going to be as dumb as he was before to make the foolish mistakes as he's made in the past. But we come to this story, and we see that Abraham's knowledge of God and his experience of God's grace made little difference at this point in his story. And we start to get our fingers out and go, shame, shame, Abraham. And all of a sudden, the Bible is held up to us as a mirror and say, listen, this isn't primarily about Abraham. This is primarily about you. For the things that were written aforetime were written for our learning. And so as the Bible's held up to us this morning, maybe it's saying, you know what? Those of you who've experienced God's grace, those of you who've known personal victory, those of you who've known private victory, those of you who've known public victory, those of you who've known personal failure, even public failure, those of you who've grown in grace, be careful. Because having known grace, it's possible to be indifferent to that grace, because at this moment, God's grace made very little difference in the life of Abraham. It says there in verse 1 that Abraham journeyed toward the Negev, the south country. We're not told why. We're not told if he has a good reason for it. We're not told that he has any divine direction for it. In fact, the fact that the Bible doesn't mention that God told him to go might mean that he just did it of his own accord. Maybe he was moved by the destruction of Sodom. That is, he might be moving away from the disappointment. Man, I just can't deal with this disappointment in my life. I just I need to do something. I'm just going to walk away. Maybe he's moving away because he's just bored or restless. God said there's going to be a baby. He even came to me and said there's going to be a baby. There's nothing happening. My life is just the same old, same old. Maybe he's walking away because he's looking for something better. Don't we do the same sometimes? We want to cut and run when we're disappointed by something. Well, that didn't turn out the way I thought it was going to turn out. So maybe I just need to walk away. Maybe I need to try find something better. God isn't working enough over here, so I need to move over this direction, and maybe God's going to work over here, and I get restless. We're not told why Abraham went. We're just told that he moved. He's in search of something, and maybe Abraham didn't even know what he was in search of. You ever been there? You're trying one thing or another. You don't know what you're looking for. Your heart is just restless. You're on the move. Abraham's on the move at this point. And as he moves, we see that Abraham says of Sarah, his wife, "She's my sister," verse 2. He gets down to Gerar. Abraham said of Sarah, his wife, "She's my sister." Fear necessitates this decision. Am I going to manipulate the circumstances, or I'm going to wait and see what God's going to do? And at this moment in his life, Abraham says, "You know what? God's taken care of me for 25 years. He might not be able to handle this one." Now, he didn't think that with his head, okay? Just like you and I don't come to that point in our lives and say, "You know what? 'Tis grace hath brought me safe thus far, but I think I need to get home by my own strength." We don't think like that. But the point is, we're not thinking. When we get into those tight places in life where it looks like life is threatening us, all of a sudden, we stop thinking and we start feeling. And in our feeling, we start to panic. We start to say, "You know what? I've got to fix this so that things don't turn out bad, so that I'm self-preserved, so that things turn out the way I want them to turn out." And so without looking back over the course of my life and remembering God's grace, not just in specific times, but over the course of all the time that's brought me to this point in life, I panic. And in my panic, I start to manipulate the circumstances. This story here presumes the knowledge of chapter 12, the journey down into Egypt. And we have the identical result there in verse 2. "And Abimelech, king of Gerar, sent and took Sarah." Just like Pharaoh did back in chapter 12. So we come to the same place in the story. Now, how does this one turn out? God's grace has been operative in Abraham's life so far. We're going to expect that it will be again. But apparently in Abraham's life, not any of the promises, chapter 15, chapter 17, chapter 12, chapter 13, apparently none of the symbols, none of the experiences, none of the lessons mattered at this point. What mattered most to Abraham right now was the fact that there was a problem, and that problem was big. You ever been there? All of the symbols, all of the Sunday school lessons that you've heard, all of the Sunday school lessons that you've taught don't seem to matter at this point, because my problem is just too big. My eyes have gotten off the prize. At this moment, grace was not good enough, but at this moment, grace was exactly what he needed. You see, oftentimes, God's people become indifferent to God's grace because we forget that we're still in need of grace. Do you ever forget that? You get saved, you know that we can only get saved by grace through faith, and that not of ourselves. It's a gift of God, not of works, lest any man should boast. We know that. Okay, so we're in. So now we're saved by grace. So now I have to gain heaven through good works, right? What kind of theology is that? We know that's not right. We know that in our heads, but we forget that in our hearts. Yes, we're supposed to work out our own salvation. With fear and trembling, we're supposed to work out our salvation. But we're supposed to remember that it's he that worketh in you, both to will and to do of his good pleasure. The only way that I can please God isn't by trying harder. It's by submitting more and trusting him for the grace and the strength, which is made perfect in weakness, by the way, to bring pleasure to Him in the difficult circumstances He brings to me in my life. God initiated my life into salvation, into this realm of grace, so that I can be a recipient of more grace. Here's the thing. God isn't a one-time grace giver. God is a lifelong grace giver. When you get to know God, His grace isn't exhausted at that moment. It's only just begun. And entering into a life of faith means entering into a life of grace. Go over to chapter 5 of the book of Romans. Romans chapter 5, verse 1. Therefore, since we've been justified by faith, we have peace with God through our Lord Jesus Christ. Through Him, we've also obtained access by faith into this grace in which we stand, and we rejoice in hope of the glory of God. I access this grace by faith, and I access more grace through faith. In fact, I am positioned, I'm stationed, I stand now in the river of God's grace. That's where God has placed me when I become a Christian, when I enter into a life of faith, a relationship with Jesus Christ. I didn't exhaust God's grace when I got saved. I got placed in the very middle of the river of God's grace that flows around me. And God has more grace to give. But I forget that I need grace. I think now that I'm in, I've got to work hard to do it myself. And God says, must I remind you, you can't do this by yourself. And He continues to send more and more obstacles in my way that helps me, in fact, to lean on Him. A second mark of those who've become indifferent to the grace of God is that when we become indifferent to God's grace, we become doubtful of others' potential to receive the grace that we know. Verses 8 down through 13, we see these. Actually, it's kind of intermixed here. Let's look down a little bit further. Abimelech is going to ask Abraham, why is it that you've done this? Go down to verse 9. Abimelech called Abraham and said to him, why have you done this to us? How have I sinned against you that you've brought on me and my kingdom such a great sin? You've done to me things that ought not to be done. Abimelech said to Abraham, verse 10, what did you see that you did this thing? And then Abraham's going to start to explain. Well, here's why. Here's why I did what I did. He says then in verse 11, Abraham said, I did this because here's what I thought. There's no fear of God at all in this place. If you want to put it in today's terms, Abraham was a cynic. When he looked out at people, he saw their very worst. He didn't expect anything good from the people, and with reason. Okay, it was a hardcore bunch of pagans, heathen, who lived like the devil. We're told something of their characteristics with Canaan as their father and all the lewd and sexually immoral acts of this people. And he says, you know what? As I look on this lot, there's no reason for me to expect that they would ever experience God's grace. I am so much different than them. Oh, we would never put it that way, would we? But we don't really expect God to work in other people's lives like He's worked in our lives. Boy, when we stop and put it into words like that, doesn't it sound just a little bit, I don't know, arrogant? Well, God worked in my life. He humbled me. He won me. He sanctified me. He could never do that to them. They're so far gone. We forget. There, but for the grace of God, go I, right? And when we forget that, we become doubtful of God's potential to work in other people's lives by faith. He's moved by presuming the worst. He says there's no fear of God at all in the place. Verse 11, they'll kill me because of my wife. He's moved by fear. They're going to kill me. They're going to take my wife. Yes, God promised me a seed, but it's going to have to come after I'm dead. I just can't put this all together. I don't know how this is going to work. He's content with a half-truth. He says, you know what? Besides, she really is my sister. She's the daughter of my dad, but not the daughter of my mom. We have different moms, same dad. She is my sister. She's my half-sister. So I was kind of telling the truth. That's one of the reasons I did it. And then we come down to a unique phrase down in verse 13. And when God caused me to wander from my father's house, this was my plan. I told her, wherever we go, tell him you're my sister. We don't see it in the English translation, but the way it comes across in the Hebrew, verse 13, is Abraham says, as the gods caused me to wander. What Abraham's doing at this point is he's speaking to pagan Abimelech. Is he saying, Abimelech, you have your gods, I have my gods, and we both know the gods are kind of capricious, you never know what gods will do, and I'm really not to blame for it myself. The gods caused me to wander, and in my wandering, I came up with this plan. He's kind of doing the same thing that Adam did back in the garden. God, the woman that you gave me is the reason for why I sinned. And Abraham appeals to Abimelech sort of as unbeliever to unbeliever. You know how the gods are. The gods caused me to wander, and so here's the plan that I came up with. Wow. This is a new low for the man of faith. Kind of ugly. Kind of surprised to see a man in this condition, a man that God would call the father of the faith. Well, wait a minute. It's not so much so that you're surprised by Abraham. Remember, this is a mirror. It's up. Look in the mirror. Have you ever been surprised at how ugly your lack of faith looks? Wow. God, I didn't know I could get that low. I didn't know I needed your grace that bad. So we see the reason for Abraham's actions, but there's a reality about Abimelech that we wouldn't expect either. Abimelech's condition was such that God was willing to work in the life of Abimelech. God is willing to warn Abimelech of evil, back in verse 3. And so it says, but God came to Abimelech in a dream by night, and God spoke to this pagan king. And God said, behold, you are a dead man, because this woman is a man's wife. We come down to verse 7. If you do not return her, know this of a surety, you will die. Why did God tell Abimelech? Because God didn't want Abimelech to die. Right? Did God have to tell Abimelech? God could have just gone, boom, done. Okay, Sarah, get back with Abraham. But God in his grace was extending grace. Grace to whom? Grace to pagan Abimelech. Okay? It's not that he was exercising great morality. We'll look at that in just a bit. But God had a mercy not only for Abraham, but for Abimelech too. And oftentimes, folks, when we get scared to share the gospel of Jesus Christ, it's because, you know what? I don't think God's big enough to work the same way that he's worked in me in that person too. They're just too far gone. It's just a precluded reality that they can't. Or God can't. And we wouldn't ever, ever say it like that. But that's what's motivating us as we take for granted the grace that we've been given. And we see the reality of Abimelech, that God was willing to warn him against evil. He was willing to restrain him from sin in verse 6. God said to him in this dream, yes, I know that you've done this in the integrity of your heart, but it was I who kept you from sinning against me. I did not let you touch her. Abimelech says, wait a minute, God, you can't kill me. Yes, she's in my harem, but I never took her into my bed. I've never approached the lady. She's not my wife. I've never touched her. And God said, you know why you didn't? It's not because it wasn't the intent of your heart. It was because I'm a bigger reality than you. I'm the king, King Abimelech. Okay? I'm the one who's in charge. I didn't let you sin as much as you wanted to sin. I'm the one who restrained you, so I didn't let you touch her. She's my property. She's not your property. Even though you're treating her like property, you go and you take her, and you want to use her for whatever means you see fit. She's not yours. She's mine. And guess what? You are too. And God restrained him from committing as much evil as he wanted to. I'm reminded of a former member who stood up one time and gave a testimony. He said, you know what? I just want to thank God for keeping me on a short leash, that he didn't let me sin as much as I was capable of sinning. There's a man who knows full well his need of God's continued grace. But in Abimelech's life, God also provided a proper perspective. Verse 7, God says, return the man's wife because he's a prophet, and he will pray for you and you will live. I want you to understand who it is, Abimelech, that you have violated. You violated me because you violated my man. He's the one that I chose to bring my message. And Abimelech says, him? Weenie little Abraham who gets scared of me? Little Abraham who's about to tell me a lie and tell me everything he did was based on a lie? You want to choose him? You want to use him? Abimelech, he's my man. And your success at this moment is by submitting to my plan through my man. And he gives her back. God provides a proper perspective. In chapter 21, just flip over one page, verse 22, Abimelech's going to get it. At that time, Abimelech and Phicol, his commander of his army, said to Abraham, God is with you in everything you do, Abraham. You're God's man. God was able to show that. Abraham didn't think God could. And so he had to veil, he had to hide, he had to manipulate to make sure that he was safe. He was going to experience God's blessing by taking it from God. God said, no, Abraham, that's not how it works. You trust me, and I give. You don't take and defame me before the peoples. Abimelech had a basic recognition of right as right and wrong. Now, it's not exactly the same as God's definition of right and wrong. We see in verse 3 of chapter 20, he sends out and he takes Sarah like she's a piece of meat. I want it. I'm going to take her. He brings her into his harem. But we see that Abimelech does have a basic sense of right and wrong, enough to acknowledge at least the necessity of justice. So God comes to Abimelech and says, Abimelech, you're a dead man because you've taken a man's wife. And Abimelech says, God, what I've done, you wouldn't kill an innocent people, would you? What I've done, verse 5, is in the integrity of my heart and the innocence of my hands. The idea of integrity is with a whole, a complete, a perfect heart, a heart that had no guile, no manipulation in it. And it's funny, he uses this word because basically he's saying, God, I don't have a heart like your servant has, like Abraham, who's trying to trick to get his own way. What I've done in the open, I've done with a whole heart. The idea behind the word innocence is clean, white, guiltless, pure. It's the word that's used when your teeth are clean because you've not had anything to eat. You've not bit into anything, and so your teeth are white because they're clean. God, I've done this with white hands. I've not sullied my hands. I've not dirtied my hands in this. Verse 9, he's asking Abraham, how have I sinned against you? I've treated you with integrity, with justice, with fairness. What have I done to you that would cause you to do this to me? I've not been unjust, and yet you've treated me unjustly. Abimelech has a sense of right and wrong. We come down to verse 16 when Abimelech gives to Abraham some 1,000 pieces of silver. The reason that he does it is because of his sense of justice. He says to Sarah, Sarah, this is a sign of your innocence. And now, in front of all who are with you, you are justified. They see that you are innocent, that your price is paid, that you've not become my property, and I have violated you wrongfully, and here's the price. And everybody will understand that you are clean in this matter. Ultimately, by grace, these unregenerate pagans then are indeed capable of fearing God. Abimelech gets the message. The first thing he does in verse 8, he wakes up. He wakes up early in the morning. He can't sleep. He gets out of bed. Guys, come here. I got something to tell you. Come on. Hey, come here. Gets all his guys around, and he says, listen, this is what God told me last night. Look at how the guys respond. And the men were very much afraid. What was Abraham's fear? There's no fear of God here. Abimelech says, whoa, guys, like, God talked to me. And the guys say, oh, no. Abraham's fear was unfounded. There was a great potential of fear in these people. So when we see an indifference to God's grace, we see that we start to believe that we don't need it. We start to believe that others won't take it. And we become negligent in our duty to channel God's grace to others. What did God call Abraham up there in verse 7? Abraham's my man. He's my prophet. This man, who's not a very good one at the moment, is the one that I have chosen to bring my message to my people. Okay, he wasn't a great one, but he's still the one that I've chosen. You've ever felt like a schnook? You ever felt like you've been God's man, that God put you in a position where you were supposed to tell somebody about Jesus and you blew it? It was a swing and a miss. Okay. And you feel about that big. So that means you're done, right? You're out. No more chances. God's done with you. He's going to hang you up, retire the uniform. You're out of here. Praise God, that's not how he works. Abraham blew it. There's no other words for it. But God's not done using him. Abraham's negligence left Abimelech vulnerable to God's judgment. If God himself hadn't intervened, what would happen to Abimelech? He would have died. Who was supposed to tell Abimelech about a God who's just and fair and righteous and pure? Abraham was supposed to tell him about that God. Abraham blew it. Abraham was the one who was supposed to channel God's grace and supposed to warn him about God's judgment. He'd just come away from a judgment scene in Sodom and Gomorrah. He was supposed to bring that message of judgment, of a holy God, to others. He blew it. Abraham's negligence left himself susceptible then to Abimelech's scorn. Down in verse 16, we referenced it. To Sarah, Abimelech says, behold, I have given to your brother 1,000 pieces of silver. To whom did he give this silver? Your brother. Sarah, I gave your brother the money. He's your brother, right? You said he's your brother. God told me he's your husband. Your brother. What we have at this moment is Abimelech saying, Abraham, you dog. And he deserves it. Okay? He deserves that scorn. John Phillips writes this: it's no part of God's usual dealings with us to shield us from the embarrassments that we bring upon ourselves by our sins. Okay? You know what part of our failure and part of what drives our failure home is consequences. Part of the consequence was Abimelech mocks God's prophet. Brother of her sister. Yeah, right. But in the end, Abimelech's encounter with grace properly opens up God's grace to Abraham. It's interesting how this story works. The one who was supposed to bring grace brought judgment. The one who ought to have received judgment becomes the vehicle of God's grace back to God's servant Abraham. So as verse 14 we come to, it says, Abimelech took sheep and oxen, male servants, female servants, and he gave them all to Abraham. And he returned his wife back to him. Abimelech experienced God's grace. Abimelech, you can keep your life. I've got the best thing I could have. I get to be alive. What do I care about all these sheep and oxen? And here, you take these, Abraham. You're God's man. God's given me grace. Here, you take this. What a turn of events. What a backwards way to work. But Abimelech's encounter with grace properly opened up God's grace to Abraham. Then he says in verse 15, "Behold, my land is before you. You dwell wherever you want." Was it really Abimelech's land? This was God's land, right? And God had proved that he's the... Interestingly, the word Abimelech means Avi, my father. Melech is king. Abimelech didn't understand that God is really the father, that God is really the king. And so Abimelech says, "Abraham, my land is open. Actually, my father's land is open to you." Oh, he's your father too. God had already promised him this land. In a turn of events then, Abraham's encounter with grace properly opened God's grace back to Abimelech. Verses 17 and 18. Abraham prayed to God and God healed Abimelech. God healed his wife. God healed his female slaves so that they bore children. The wife had closed all the wombs of the house of Abimelech because of Sarah, Abraham's wife. What we're going to find here as this chapter closes, verse 18, is that God, in preserving Sarah from Abimelech's seed, uniquely preserved his blessings for Abimelech and his people through Abraham's seed, through Sarah. That is, by protecting Sarah so that Abimelech did not sleep with her, he couldn't produce a child, God took Sarah and gave her back to Abraham, and he was able to fulfill his promise of one through whom none other than the Messiah was to be born. And then through the Messiah, not just Abraham and his people would be saved, but through him all nations on earth would be blessed. And as we come to this part of the story, we see that Satan was very involved in trying to mess up God's plan and trying to interject different things, and there's a lot at stake. But God says, "No, I'm the king. And Abraham, though you've not appreciated my grace, though you've not understood that you've needed my grace, I will graciously intervene because I'm the one who writes my own story." I wonder this morning, as a child of God, if grace is still making a difference in your life, or if you're allowing the circumstances, the pressures, the pains, the trials of life to cause you to act like the world. You realize that if you belong to God, God says, "You're my man, you're my lady, you're my channel of grace to others." Don't be a clogged artery. A life indifferent to God's grace is marked by a heedlessness of our own continued need of grace. A life indifferent to God's grace is marked by a doubtfulness that others can ever receive God's grace. Life indifferent to God's grace is marked by a negligence in our duty to offer God's grace to others. Let God's grace make a difference in your life. "'Tis grace hath brought us safe thus far, and grace will lead me home."